live from Phoenix, Arizona. This is the Progressive Technology Hour, and I'm your host, Dr. Houdini. I would like to welcome you to a truly unique talk show program that focuses on exotic technologies. What are exotic technologies? Well, this includes such areas as free energy, gravity, anti-gravity control, the study of the nature of time, and time travel. We'll explore not only the technology, but also the how-to part of the technology. So let's have some fun today and explore the world of exotic technologies. Well, you know, I think the Germans discovered gravity, you know, and exactly how to control it. And they did so with the device called the Nazi Bell device, and was developed back in the early 40s at a concentration camp. You know, they built all their concentration camps next to their war machine, you know, their factories, you know, because they had cheap slave labor. You know, to build, you know, their war machine. So I don't think there's any question about it. You know, I did the experiments, and lo and behold, torsion is what gravity is. It's the spinning of space. You know, as it wraps around atomic particles. You know, because every particle spins, and space-time. Spins around these particles, and what you have is a torsion field effect, and that exactly is what gravity is. So let's check out, what exactly is energy, folks? That's going to be the subject of my discussion today, energy. And there was a very interesting article that you can pick up at your newsstand today. And it's the energy issue in a magazine called Good. The Good Magazine. Interesting title. And in this energy issue, they cover Energy 101. And I thought I'd cover that today because, some of the things that we talk about on this show, exotic technologies, deal exactly with energy. And, you know, whether you look at gravitational energy or, some of these exotic technology devices, over-unity devices that seem to violate, these so-called laws of physics. And I thought I'd go over some of the basics, you know, in this article. And the title of this article here is Energy 101. And they start the article off by saying, or asking a question here, you know, what is energy? And they say that scientists say that energy is the ability to do work. But really, energy is in everything you can possibly think of. It makes change possible. It toasts your bread and keeps your freezer cold. It moves your car forward and moves you down the sidewalk. It changes your iPod and then carries. It charges your iPod and then carries the tunes as sound to your eardrum. Energy is needed for your body to grow and function, and energy allows our minds to think. Our entire civilization has become what it is because humans have learned how to change energy from one form to another and to use it to do work for us. Okay, so in this article, they talk about the various forms that energy takes here, the forms of energy. One is chemical energy. It's the energy stored in the bonds of atoms and molecules. When these bonds are broken by a chemical reaction, the energy is released. Examples, the burning of coal, petroleum, natural gas, and biomass. Another form of energy is mechanical energy. And this is energy that's stored in objects by tension. Examples include compressed springs and stretched rubber bands. Another form of energy is nuclear energy. And this is energy that's stored in the nucleus of an atom. It's the energy that actually holds the nucleus together. Large amounts of energy can be released when the nuclei are combined or split apart. You know, hence we look at fission. You know, fission is breaking apart. Fusion is combining. Okay, fusion reactors. And it's interesting to note here, folks, you know, that I covered on last week's show, you know, about cold fusion. And so examples include nuclear power plants that split the nuclei of uranium atoms, a process called fission. The sun combines the nuclei of hydrogen atoms in a process called fusion. Another form of energy is gravitational energy. Okay, and we get into that with, you know, this Nazi Bell device. Okay, so their description of it is gravitational energy is energy stored in an object's position or height. The higher and heavier the object, the more gravitational energy is stored. Example, rolling a boulder up a hill gives it more gravitational energy. When you roll it down a hill, the gravitational energy is converted to kinetic energy. Now, gravitational energy is rather interesting, you know, because that's an area that I work with, you know, I've done some experiments with. And see, what the Germans knew is this torsion field effect, you know, that these atoms are actually spinning in space. So what you have, what gravity really is this torsion or this spinning effect, like a vortex, you know, coming from atomic coming from atoms, actually. Okay, so electrical energy is the presence and flow of an electric charge, often stored in a battery and usually delivered through a wire in the form of electrons. Example, electrical energy is stored in the battery in your cell phone and in one that starts your car. It also travels through the power grid into your home. Lightning and static electricity are two other examples that are not confined to batteries and wires. Now, what's interesting about, you know, I did some research in this area, and I discovered that the flow, okay, the electron flow through a wire, the field that's produced is a relativistic effect. So, in other words, that as these atoms move, or these electrons move through a wire, the field energy, okay, the magnetic field energy that's produced by that is directly related to the motion, okay, of those electrons. It's a relativistic effect and obeys Einstein's theory of special relativity. Okay, another form of energy here, radiant energy, okay, is the electromagnetic energy that travels in waves. Now, they also think that there's a duality here, too. Okay, wave and particle. So, if we look at just from a wave aspect here, okay, radiant energy is electromagnetic energy that travels in waves. including visible light, radio waves, X-rays, and gamma rays. But they also include, you know, the entire electromagnetic wave band, you know, which is what? Infrared and radio waves and microwaves. The example includes sunshine and radiant energy, providing warmth and fuel that makes all life possible on Earth. Another form of energy is thermal energy. Better known as heat, is the vibration and movement of the atoms and molecules within substances. As the atoms and molecules within an object move and collide faster, more heat is created. Example, geothermal energy is the thermal energy within the Earth. And a great place for capturing this thermal energy, perhaps you heard of it, is in Iceland. Okay, motion energy. Motion energy is energy stored in the movement of objects. An object in motion wants to stay in motion, which is Newton's first law. Second law, and here they note the second law of thermodynamics, which is what we're going to get into a little later on here. And the faster it moves, the more energy is stored. Example, a car rolling downhill carries energy that is released when the brakes are applied. And just one interesting little side note, you know, with about a car rolling down a hill, you know, I researched these gravitational mystery spots. And you can find that on my research page at intalek.com, and that's spelled intalek.com. And there's these various spots located around the Earth here where you run across these gravitational anomalies, and there's some interesting effects with those. And I've studied those too. So you can check out my research site. Sound. Okay, sound is produced when a force causes an object or substance to vibrate, transferring energy through the substance in a wave. Generally speaking, the energy in sound is very small compared with other forms of energy. But that's basically it, folks. Okay, this is what mainstream science knows about energy. And of course, on this show, we kind of open up the envelope here. And we include, you know, what the Germans discovered, you know, about torsion field, is that the vacuum is what is generally referred to as the active vacuum, is actually filled with an ether. And this ether is an electromagnetic media, okay, and it's a media by which to transfer electromagnetic energy. Okay, that's what the vacuum is filled with. And we know it exists because of, you know, free space, you know, the impedance of free space. And this is something that's studied in, you know, some electrical engineering courses. And you can actually just Google it, you know, the impedance of free space. Impedance of free space. Just Google that. And you'll see some interesting information pop up that just free space alone, you know, has this electromagnetic quality to it. So that is the ether. It's electromagnetic ether. And this is what is spinning around atoms. Okay, that accumulates around atoms as they spin is this torsion field effect. And so you can kind of think of it as like a frame dragging effect. Okay, so that as the ether spins around atoms, you know, because all these atoms, you know, they're associated with charges, Okay, so they're connected to this electromagnetic medium through the charge of the particles that make up the atoms, and so they're all spinning and producing gravity. Okay, because of the spinning vortex concept, you know, the spinning medium. And so what you have is, you know, as it accumulates around atoms, you know, it's spinning around atoms, you actually have a thinning of space between the atoms. You know, you can kind of think of it as take an aluminum can and grab it at both ends and twist it. Okay, you apply a torsion, okay, to that can. So as you twist the can, you notice that the two ends start to approach one another, and that the relative density of you know, if you use an aluminum can, the relative density, you know, increases towards the ends, okay, but it's decreased towards the center. So you have a buildup of material, you know, in this case, you know, space-time media, you know, around these atoms. And that's exactly what gravity is. You know, it's this torsion effect, this twisting of space, of the space-time media, I should say. Okay, so we look at the laws of energy. And this is where things get interesting, because you always hear about perpetual motion devices. You know, and that's a subject we cover, you know, on this show. But you see, once you understand gravity, you know, and the twisting of space, you begin to realize, you know, what space is filled with, and that these particles are spinning continuously. Okay, they're in a perpetual state of motion. And the whole idea behind this is to be able to harness, okay, this torsion field effect. And so what we look into, what we're actually getting into is essentially perpetual motion, okay? But mainstream science considers this a taboo subject, you know, that these perpetual motion devices simply don't exist. And you cannot get a patent at a patent office, okay, if you're claiming perpetual motion. Only because they don't understand, okay, you know, torsion field effect of atoms. You know, the mainstream science just doesn't get it. Okay, so let's proceed here. Okay, the laws of energy. There are two main laws of energy, which you may know as the laws of thermodynamics. The first law of thermodynamics involves the conservation of energy. In this case, conservation doesn't mean flipping off a light switch or turning down your thermostat. Rather, the law of conservation says that energy is neither created nor destroyed. It can only be transformed from one form of energy to another. Energy changes form, but the total amount of energy in the universe always remains the same. So the question is, how do they know that? Well, you see, what they do in science is that they take a box, okay, and you fit your device inside this box. And that's your, essentially, your universe. And the laws, for the most part, work within that box, okay? But you'll typically hear, okay, with over-unity devices, that you're dealing with what are generally referred to as open systems. So you're open to the universe, you know, as a source of energy. And in this case, harnessing, okay, this energy. So the first law mainly deals with energy can be neither created nor destroyed. But then you have to factor in this box and make the box essentially the size of the universe. And which really isn't known. I mean, the Big Bang Theory is exactly that. It's just a theory. you know, but they really don't know, you know, how big the universe really is. So, energy can be neither created nor destroyed. So the energy in the universe is essentially fixed. So here they show various examples, you know, chemical to motion, radiant to chemical, chemical to motion, electrical to thermal. So various examples, you know, the first law here. So we're mainly transforming energy from one form to another. Now, you know, with over-unity devices, we're using, you know, the energy that's in the universe, okay, in this generally referred to as the quantum vacuum. And cohering that energy, okay, and utilizing it in the form of this torsion effect. Because, you know, there were some interesting examples done back in the 60s. And I show that on my research site, you know, about this. You know, that there's energy that you can harness gravitational energy just by using a photon, okay? A photon directed towards the Earth increases in energy. If a photon is leaving the Earth, it decreases in energy. You know, it's affected by gravity. Okay, so now we get to the second law of thermodynamics. The second law is a little more complex, but basically says that any time you do work, including any time energy is transformed from one form to the other, which is the first law, some of the initial energy is going to be lost, usually as heat. Thus, the energy efficiency of a system is the amount of useful energy you get from the transformations. A perfectly energy efficient machine would change 100% of the energy to work. But that is impossible. Otherwise, we would have invented a perpetual motion machine for now. Okay, so what we're looking at here with the second law of thermodynamics, okay, fixes the overall efficiency of your device to 100%. Okay, and any losses in that system, you know, your system is inside of a box. You put it inside of a box, and you say that the efficiency of that system shall not exceed, it's 100%. The transformation from one form of energy to another is 100%. Okay, so this concept is well known in physics. Okay. So, any losses in your system, okay, usually come in the form of heat. You know, if you're looking at an electrical system, you know, your components get hot. So your efficiency in that case can really never be above 100%. Okay, and some of these switching regulators, you know, you can perhaps approach, you know, 95%. So you have a 5% loss as heat. Okay, so you use heat sinks on your devices. So what they're really saying here is that you can't go over 100% for what? A closed system. But they kind of leave that part out. Okay, so for example, when you drive your car, some of the gasoline's energy is lost immediately as heat. Touch your hood after a drive. But some is converted to mechanical energy. Even some of that mechanical energy, though, is lost as heat. Touch your tires after a long drive, and they'll be warm from friction with the road. That heat is the energy lost. So, you know, that's the whole crux of the second law of thermodynamics. But now when we deal, you know, we talk about over-unity devices and, you know, the various guests that I had on my show, what you have to factor in, folks, is that, you know, with over-unity devices, they're essentially open systems. You know, they're not closed within a box here and given a maximum percentile of 100% efficiency. When you deal with open systems, you can have something that's over 100% efficient. Okay? It's just how the vacuum, okay, is being utilized. You know, that's the whole key to this thing, is this vacuum energy. Okay, so let's proceed here. Energy versus electricity. Electricity is technically a secondary energy source, also known as an energy carrier. Electricity is the flow of electrical power or charge. It is characterized by the presence and motion of elementary charged particles generated by friction, induction, or chemical change. It occurs naturally in nature and is also one of the most widely used forms of energy by humans. As a secondary energy source, we get electricity from the conversion of other primary sources of energy, such as burning coal, converting solar power, or nuclear fission. And so, you know, an interesting area of research here is, of course, electric energy. And so, you know, I've done some work in this area myself, and I've noticed some very interesting effects occur. Again, you can go to my Intellect website, and that's spelled intalek.com, intalek.com, and check out some of my research in this area. And as I mentioned earlier, is that the flow of electrons in a wire is a relativistic effect. You know, it's Einstein's special relativity that comes into effect here. Because what is increasing that magnetic field energy, okay, as these electrons flow? Okay, it's the relative motion of electrons through a wire, okay? Okay, so now we look at a topic here called energy units, and they cover some various energy units here, which are quite useful. They say all different types of forms of energy are measured by different physical units. The first one here is the BTU, British Thermal Units. As it is commonly used unit for comparing the amount of energy in fuels, the BTU is a measure of the heat content in a fuel. Technically, it's the quantity of heat required to raise the temperature of 1 pound of liquid water by 1 degree Fahrenheit. Let me repeat that. It's the quantity of heat required to raise the temperature of 1 pound of liquid water by 1 degree Fahrenheit. BTUs are useful in comparing how much energy a certain amount of an energy source actually has. For instance, you can compare 1 gallon of propane, which has about 91,000 BTUs, to 1 gallon of home heating oil, which has 138,000 BTUs. And learn that home heating oil contains more energy. Utilities also often use BTUs to compare relative cost of source fuels. One BTU is actually very small, about the same amount of energy as is released when you light a match. Scientists and utilities generally speak of BTUs in the millions, billions, and trillions, and quadrillions. That's one followed by 15 zeros, which is called a quad. Other units common in measuring energy. Okay? A barrel. A unit of volume equal to 42 U.S. gallons, generally used to measure crude oil. So you often hear of crude oil being measured in barrels. So here we have a unit of volume equal to 42 U.S. gallons. A calorie. A unit for measuring heat energy, typically used when dealing with the energy released from food. One calorie is equal to 4.184 joules. Okay? One calorie is equal to 4.184 joules. A cubic foot. A unit of volume commonly used to measure natural gas and other fuels in the gaseous state. A gallon. A unit of volume equal to 4 quarts used to measure liquid fuels like gasoline, heating oil, diesel, and propane. Horsepower. A unit for measuring the power or rate of work equivalent to 746 watts. So 1 horsepower equals 746 watts. A joule. A basic metric unit for measuring work. 1 joule is equal to the work done when 1 amp of current is passed through a resistance of 1 ohm for 1 second. That is 1 joule. A quad. 1 quadrillion British thermal units. A ton, or short ton. Unit of weight equal to 2,000 pounds. Coal is generally measured in short tons, which are commonly just called tons here in the U.S. Electricity has its own set of units. The 3 most common, of course, are voltage, current, and resistance. To better understand these, here's an analog. Think of electrical wires like plumbing. The voltage is the water resistance. The current is the rate the water flows, and the resistance is the size of the pipe. And, of course, they get into Ohm's law. Power. Power is the rate at which work is performed or energy is converted. In an electrical system, instantaneous power, how much work can be done at that instant, is measured in watts. So power is typically an instantaneous measurement. You know, it's whatever you measure at that moment. That's power. And then power also equals voltage times current. That's another equation here. The water analogy still holds. Take a hose and point it at a turbine. You can produce more power by either increasing the water pressure, voltage, or by increasing the flow rate, current. And of course, power is measured in watts. Watts give the rate at which work is done or energy is used at that moment. 1 watt equals 1 joule per second. Common multiples of watts, kilowatts, megawatts, gigawatts, and so on. A kilowatt hour, the common measure of electricity use that describes how much work is done over time. A kilowatt hour is 1 kilowatt of power expended for 1 hour. 100-watt light bulb left on for an hour uses 0.1 kilowatt hours. Your home electricity is billed in kilowatt hours. So again, folks, if you take a 100-watt light bulb and left it on for an hour, that uses 0.1 kilowatt hours. Alternating current versus direct current. Direct current is an electric current that flows in one direction through a circuit. It's from a battery, fuel cell, or solar cell. The positive and negative terminals of a battery always remains the same. And so current always flows in the same direction between those two terminals. Alternating AC is an electric current that reverses its direction at regular intervals or cycles. In the United States, which uses alternating current, okay, brought to you by who? Tesla. The standard is 120 reversals or 60 cycles per second for the residential grid. Energy sources. There are many sources of energy, but they are classified in two groups, renewable and non-renewable electricity. Electricity can come from renewable or non-renewable sources, but it is neither renewable nor non-renewable by itself. That sounds confusing. Renewable energy sources regenerate or are replenished naturally and can be sustained indefinitely. Sometimes you may hear these sources described as alternative clean green energy. Non-renewable energy sources are those that cannot be replenished in a short period of time. These come out of the ground as liquid, gases, and solids, and the resources can run out over time. Fossil fuels are all non-renewable. Well, that's somewhat questionable, folks, because I'm into the abiotic oil concept, and that is oils produced in deep inside the earth. And so the article goes on here, say that fossil fuels are all non-renewable, but not all non-renewable sources are fossil fuels. Uranium ore is mined and converted to a fuel used at nuclear power plants and is not a fossil fuel. So again, you know, I question this the statement here that says fossil fuels are all non-renewable. Because if you check out my research site, intellect.com, I get into a little bit of that. Check out the Tesla Tech Show from a few years back. And you'll see an interesting presentation by a researcher. He's a German professor. His last name is Miles. And he has a very interesting theory that the center of the Earth collects neutrinos, and that these neutrinos are converted into fundamental particles and atoms, such as hydrogen. And so he's providing a mechanism where the Earth is in a continuous state of growth, and it will continue growing until it either explodes or breaks apart, you know, hence the exploded planet theory. And Tesla, you know, if you look at Tesla, Tesla also knew this too. And that was rather interesting. So that is pretty much what this article is about, folks. You know, I thought I'd touch on Energy 101, you know, go over some of the basics. And cover, you know, the first and second laws of thermodynamics and the violation, you know, that the claim of violation. You know, we're dealing with open systems here, that the second law of thermodynamics can be violated. Okay, if we look at thermodynamics as being inside of a box, you know, as a closed system. And that if it's open to the universe, okay, that, you know, you have to deal with it as an open system in that case. And so when you do so, you know, it you have a entirely different situation. You know, that the second law becomes, you know, is essentially becomes invalid. Okay, so, you know, there were some interesting news articles, you know, also in that magazine you can check out. And again, it's called the Good Magazine, G-O-O-D, and it's the energy issue. And you can also Google it. And, you know, they have an article in here about smart meters. And it's called Smart Meters Dumb Backlash. I wonder what they mean by that. Okay, so in this article, it's dated January 15, 2011. Smart Meters Dumb Backlash. Okay, so the article, Smart Meters Can Save Energy and Money and Prevent Blackouts. So why did the residents of Bakersfield, California, hate them so much? As Barack Obama signed the $787 billion economic stimulus back in February of 2009, he promised it would place smart meters in homes to make our energy bills lower, makes outages less likely, and make it easier to use clean energy. Sounds great, right? But in Bakersfield, California, one of the first American cities to get smart meters on a large scale, many residents hate them. Pacific Gas and Electric, California's largest utility company, was sure its smart meters would be a hit. Instead, it faced an unexpected consumer backlash and a public relations nightmare. You know, I mean, what are they doing? I mean, they're moving a step towards Big Brother here, you know, to control everything in our lives. Okay, so the first, the basics. A smart meter is just a high-tech version of your current home electricity meter. What makes it smart is that it can measure a house's energy use in real time or near real time and report back to the utility company remotely. Okay, so it's essentially taking your instant usage here, okay, what power you're using, okay, and sending that information back to a utility company. Because they can send information back to the utility company, smart meters make meter reading trips to the customer's home unnecessary. Okay, so you have a cost savings here. You know, you essentially get rid of the guy, the meter reader, right? The guy or gal there who goes around reading meters, you know, they're out of a job. So, yeah, the utilities are going to be happy about that. Okay, so that saves utility companies money, yeah. Okay. But the big benefit of smart meters is dynamic pricing. Oh, now we get into some nitty-gritty here. By providing utility companies with near real-time information about how much energy people in a given area are using, smart meters allow them to set the price for electricity according to the current demand. So what we have here is, you know, supply and demand here. And that the controller of all this is, of course, the utility company, which can fluctuate their rate. Now, rates are supposed to be approved, I believe. You know, I think it's at a local level that they're able to set rates. But if they're able to dynamically set this price, this is where things can get out of control. Okay, so the article goes on here. That means that the price of electricity might be higher in the middle of of a hot summer afternoon when lots of people are using air conditioners, and lower during a temperature spring night when most appliances are off. With dynamic pricing, consumers know when to conserve. The utility company knows how much... Now, wait a minute here. With dynamic pricing, the consumer knows when to conserve? I mean, come on. The utility company knows how much electricity to provide at any given time, and the outages are much less likely because the variable price keeps supply and demand in balance. So, what does that mean? If you're using a lot of power during the day, you know, keeping your house cool, you know, like here in the desert, using utilities, the price is going to be a lot higher. Is that what it is? So, with that in mind, you're kind of psychologically affecting the consumer here. It sounds like a big psyop, doesn't it, folks? A big psyop going on here. So, after California's energy crisis of 2000 and 2001, which was a big Enron scam, okay? There was a huge scam going on there, folks, you know, with this energy crisis back in 2000 and 2001. The promise that dynamic pricing could prevent blackouts was especially attractive. As Governor Gray Davis said at the time, rising prices during periods of peak demand would have solved this problem in 20 minutes. Rising prices. That somehow raising the price of electricity is going to solve the problem. You know, if that had anything to do, I kind of doubt that. Okay, from 2003 to 2005, California ran a pilot study with 2,500 customers to make sure people actually responded to dynamic prices. The results were dramatic. You know, that's like a balloon payment on a mortgage, isn't it? I mean, you can overprice it to the point where you drive... Your customer, they're right out of business, right out of their home. Isn't that the scam that's going on today, folks? A huge bubble scam, you know, forcing people out of their homes. So in this case, it's forcing people to, what, turn off their electricity? Is that what they're doing? But, you know, that's not what that 2000 and 2001 scam was all about. You know, that was strictly a money-making scam. Okay, it had nothing to do with this demand of electricity. Okay, so the results were dramatic. With dynamic pricing, people dropped their peak demand by 13%. So in 2006, PG&E started handing out smart meters in Bakersfield, a fast-growing oil and agricultural city in the hot Central Valley. For 2 years, the rollout in Bakersfield went smoothly enough. Then suddenly, late in summer of 2009, customers started complaining. The bills had spiked considerably, they said, and many were suspicious that the new smart meters might be at fault. This was surprising. The initial rollout didn't involve dynamic pricing. It was just laying the groundwork by getting the smart meters into people's homes. So here they have, you know, a cute little scam going here. In a blog for Bakersfield, Californian, a local communist named Lewis Henry began covering and cultivating the growing controversy in posts with the titles like PG&E Can't Tell a Straight Story with the Ruler. She recounts reports of hundreds of complaints about bills that had jumped 100, 200, and even 400%. So, yeah, I mean, you have a huge money-making scam going on here again. It's just taken another, a different form, really. And freely speculating, speculated about PG&E's faulty technology and fishy motives. Around the same time, Dean Flores, a local state senator, demanded that PG&E halt the installation of smart meters. He began holding town hall meetings enthusiastically promoted by Henry to hear complaints. An October meeting drew 200 angry citizens. PG&E consistently denied that anything was wrong with the meters and blamed the high bills on a hot summer. But, you know, I mean, come on. I mean, they're allowed to bilk the public here, you know, just rape them of more money. But public suspicion grew, and as it did, so did the range of concerns. Were the smart meters safe? A smart meter had caused a small fire in a Bakersfield vacuum shop. Did they compromise privacy? It seemed PG&E would be able to see when people were home by looking at their hour-to-hour electricity use. Could smart meters cause cancer? Where did that come from? What kind of a weird statement is that? Cause cancer. Come on. And then the statement before that had to do with PG&E essentially looking inside your home. But you know, folks, you know, I heard, you know, I work in a contractor business here as an independent contractor. And I've heard stories where, you know, interesting stories, you know, about, you know, some people doing this classified work, you know, at military contractors. And they have to carefully monitor, okay, the electricity usage there, because you can tell, you know, what the what a programmer is typing in on their keyboard by looking at power usage on your power line. You know, I kid you not. And so what we have here are prying eyes looking into your home through your smart meter to see if you're home or not. Okay, so confusion reigned by November despite scan evidence that the smart meter themselves had caused any problems. PG&E faced a class action lawsuit from Bakersfield residents. Finally, the California Public Utilities Commission hired a Houston-based consulting firm, the Structure Group, to conduct an independent report on PG&E smart meters. Roughly a year after the controversy had erupted, the Structure Group reported that it did not identify systemic issues in the measuring and billing of electric usage within the PG&E smart meter systems. The meters were exonerated. So why, 2 years after installation began, did this powerful consumer backlash materialize seemingly out of nowhere? I mean, come out of nowhere? Excuse me? Out of the money-making scam here that's going on. And so as the Structure Group explains, it was a confluence of factors. While the summer of 2009 wasn't too much hotter on average than the year before, the month of July was. In July of 2009, Bakersfield had 17 days that topped 100 degrees, compared with just 6 days the year before. Okay, so it was hot, which then allowed them to gouge the customer a lot more here. You know, which is what this game is all about. Okay, so the point of these inverted tier rates was to encourage conservation. Okay, PG&E started charging for electricity based on new inverted tier rate. They're calling it an inverted tier rate system. It's for the electricity billing system. There were five tiers, and the more energy you used, the more you paid per unit. To use a car analogy, it works like this. If you pump 5 gallons of gas, you pay $2 per gallon. Pump 10 gallons, the price jumps to $3 a gallon. As Ahmed Farkai, an energy economist with the Brattle Group says it's the opposite of Costco pricing. Yeah, that's true. Consume more electricity, the price should go down, right? Well, in this case, you know, the price, you know, if you go to the pump, the price doesn't change at all. You know, it's still $2 a gallon. Or in this case, some places, it's $3. The point of these inverted tier rates was to encourage conservation among the heaviest electricity users. But during the especially hot July 2009, many users were bumped into the higher use tiers for the first time without knowing it. So, I mean, that's their bitch, okay? It's this price gouging. Not only were they using more electricity because of the heat, they were also paying more per unit of electricity they used. The problem was that people didn't understand how much energy they were using or how they were being charged for it. PG&E didn't do much to help, according to the Structure Group. So, I mean, that's where the whole crux of this thing lies. So, Farkai says the controversy in Bakersfield has damaged smart meter's reputation, even though the technology itself wasn't to blame. So, you know, the price gouging opportunity here, the price gouging opportunity is really what killed this thing. What happened in Bakersfield, what can we do to prevent it? You know, that's what they're trying to figure out. So, you know, the article just goes on and on and on here about a bunch of nonsense. Bakersfield, the last paragraph, the Bakersfield has become a metaphor. Farkai says some people don't even know there's a town. No, come on, Bakersfield. They just know there was something called the Bakersfield problem. Okay. So that's a shot down there. You know, that's a shot across the bow of for smart meters here. You know, that people are going to have a major bitch here, you know, with this price gouging that's going on. Okay? I mean, that's what the game here is about. They had that huge energy Enron scam going back, 1999, 2000, 2001. And so, well, you know what? I'm out of time, folks. See how that hour goes? So, next week, we're hoping to have Ben Schwartz on, you know, talking about his energy devices. And we're going to get into more of these violations of the second law of thermodynamics, folks. That's going to be interesting. So that's going to be coming up very soon here. So I want to thank you all for joining me in this hour and interesting topics that we talk about here on the Progressive Technology Hour. And coming up next here is Michael Elajan and his communication with these cosmic beings. Yes, the ETs. You know, what do they have to say about all this? That's coming up next on Vortex Net